Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, July 28th.
One of the scariest things about January 6th is that the people that were there, even to this day, think that they were right. And that makes for a scary recipe for the future of this country.
And that was Officer Harry Dunn testifying yesterday before the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. We'll play a few clips from that testimony that you may not have heard yet because they're not the ones most being repeated in news coverage. But here's a clip not from yesterday's hearing, but from January 6th itself, that's prompting yet another kind of legal response. The Justice Department issued an opinion yesterday that Republican Congressman Mo Brooks of Alabama can be sued for inciting the riot because of a speech he gave at the rally leading up to the attack that seemed to call for the violence that followed. Here's 1 minute from that speech. Again, this is Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks addressing the crowd on January 6th.
As such, today is important in another way. Today is the day American patriots start taking down names and kicking ass. Now, our ancestors sacrificed their blood, their sweat, their tears, their fortunes, and sometimes their lives to give us, their descendants, an America that is the greatest nation in world history. So I have a question for you. Are you willing to do the same? My answer is yes. Louder, are you willing to do what it takes to fight for America? Louder, will you fight for America?
Republican Congressman Mo Brooks of Alabama addressing the crowd on January 6th, and fight they did. Brooks is now being sued by Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell of California for inciting the violence. So did statements like that by Mo Brooks that riled up the crowd lead to moments like this, described in the hearing yesterday by Officer Daniel Hodges? Hodges was being physically attacked, he said, poked in the eye, sprayed by wasp spray, had his police radio stolen, so he was isolated, all while people were shouting slogans at him. He testified that one guy shouted, 4 more years.
Another shouted, do not attack us, we're not Black Lives Matter, as if political affiliation is how we determine when to use force. A man in a QAnon hoodie exclaims, this is the time to choose which side of history to be on. A man whose shirt read God, Guns, and Trump stood behind him, silently holding a Trump flag. A new man came to the front and fixated on me, continually berating me, telling me to take off my gear and give it to him, to show solidarity with we the people, or we're gonna run over you. His voice cracked with the strain and the volume of his threats. He continued, do you think your little pea shooter guns are gonna stop this crowd? No, we're going in that building.
Officer Daniel Hodges yesterday at the committee hearing. We've got more clips to play too, but could Congressman Mo Brooks and others be held legally responsible for things like that? And joining us now is Washington Post correspondent Jacqueline Alemany, who writes their daily newsletter called Power Up, and also has an article today on reaction to the hearing, and Washington Post reporter Devlin Barrett, who focuses on national security and law enforcement. He wrote up the Mo Brooks and Justice Department piece of this today, and he's the author of the book, October Surprise, How the FBI Tried to Save Itself and Crashed an Election, that book published last year. Jacqueline and Devlin, welcome back to WNYC. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Morning, Brian.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And Devlin, can we start with Mo Brooks? Why is one member of Congress being sued by another, California Democrat Eric Swalwell, over January 6th?
Well, Swalwell filed suit against Mo Brooks and three of the other speakers at that rally on January 6th, President Trump himself, Donald Trump Jr., and Rudy Giuliani. Now, in Brooks' case, it's a little complicated because the law is very protective of members of Congress and their public statements. And the law very broadly protects lawmakers from being sued over those statements. But in a pretty remarkable filing late last night, the Justice Department said Brooks can't be protected by that law because the law cannot protect inciting or conspiring to foment an attack on the United States Congress.
That's a civil lawsuit, not a criminal case. So what is Swalwell suing for? Some kind of damages paid to somebody or what exactly?
Right. He's suing for damages on a number of legal fronts. One is just classic tort law, i.e. suing for money. But he's also claiming that the people he's suing conspired to violate folks' civil rights, which gives him another legal line of attack on this. This is all very, I think it's safe to say, unusual litigation to members of a member of Congress suing another member and a former president. But that is the moment we are in when it comes to January 6th. There are decisions that have to be made on circumstances that we've just never seen before.
And the Justice Department opinion yesterday that Brooks could be sued, this was an opinion submitted to the judge in the case, was that Brooks is not exempt as a member of Congress from being sued. What's the issue there?
So the issue is that traditionally and most of the time, elected officials, up to and including the president, are protected from most lawsuits, particularly for things like defamation, when it comes to their public statements. And the sort of the classic example that folks point to is, in one instance, a lawmaker was asked, this is years ago, a lawmaker was asked why he was getting a divorce, and the lawmaker blamed a nearby mosque that he claimed had, you know, driven his wife crazy. There was a lawsuit over that statement, and what the courts found was that almost anything a lawmaker says can be considered part of his job as a member of Congress. And so therefore that is protected and cannot be sued over that. What's really remarkable, I think, about what the Justice Department is saying is that they're really drawing a line in the sand and say some things that people say are just so beyond the pale that they can't be protected. And Mo Brooks' comments, they decide, are over that line. Now, a judge still has to decide. That the Justice Department is not the last word on this, but it's obviously an important development.
So the clip we played from yesterday's testimony of Officer Hodges touched on another of the themes from the testimony, besides how much he was being attacked and what kind of flags and slogans there were, the white nationalist consciousness of many of the insurrectionists. We heard Hodges quote one of them saying, "Don't shoot us. We're not Black Lives Matter." That was in that clip. He said, as if political affiliation would determine when he would use force. Then there was this moment of testimony by Officer Aquilino Gunnell, who happens to be Dominican American and a U.S. military veteran, before he became a police officer. Officer Gunnell testified about having his presence questioned by a member of the crowd saying, "You're not even an American."
Apparently, they seen, even through my mask, they saw my skin color and said, "You're not even an American," regardless whether I was in the military. They don't know that, but they yelling and saying all these things to me. I mean, when I heard that, I wasn't even thinking about any racial stuff. I'd be like, okay, you don't know that for a fact, so I'm not even entertaining that.
So there was that, Officer Gunnell. And back to Officer Hodges, who's white, he testified that he thought the crowd was staging a white nationalist insurrection. And California Congressman Pete Aguilar asked him a follow-up question.
Officer Hodges, you characterized the attack on the Capitol as a white nationalist insurrection. Can you describe what you saw that led you to label the attack that way?
The crowd was overwhelmingly white males, usually a little bit older, middle age, older, but some younger. I think out of the entire time I was there, I saw just two women and two Asian males. Everyone else was white males. They didn't say anything especially xenophobic to me, but to my black colleagues and anyone who's not white. And they would, some of them would try to recruit me. One of them came up to me and said, "Are you my brother?" There are many many known organizations with ties to white supremacy. We had a presence there. I know like 3%ers, Oath Keepers, that kind of thing. And everyone I've ever, people who associate with Donald Trump are find more likely to subscribe to that kind of belief system.
Officer Daniel Hodges, from yesterday's testimony. There was also the disturbing collection of stories told by Officer Harry Dunn that we've aired multiple times on the station already, describing multiple incidents of police officers who are black being called the N-word on January 6th. Washington Post correspondent Jacqueline Alemany, you reported on another moment that I don't have tape of, when Congresswoman Liz Cheney asked Officer Gunnell, the Dominican American officer whose clip we just played, how it made him feel that Donald Trump described the insurrectionists as a loving crowd. Do you know the context of that? Like, when did Trump say that?
Yeah, that was actually in the scramble in the hours right when the insurrection had started. And there were aides and people around President Trump, former President Trump, who were rushing in and out of the Oval Office and trying to apply pressure on him as he watched the coverage play out on cable news to issue a formal statement stopping the violence and telling the insurrectionists to call it off, either via Twitter or a White House statement. And there were several statements put out by him over the course of the day. And, you know, I can't remember the exact ordering off the top of my head, but a number of them were very sympathetic to the rioters and continued to encourage them and did not accomplish that goal of condemning and asking them to stop the violence and, which, you know, was counter to the message that we had heard from him for months by that point. He had been talking about the Stop the Steal rally and encouraging these people to travel across the country to storm the Capitol. Really, since he lost the election, started propagating false claims of election fraud and trying to discredit, at that point, President-elect Joe Biden's electoral victory. But you heard Gunnell say that really discredit and express hurt and anger at the former president's statements, making the point that if these were loving people, if there were hugs and kisses, then they should go, you know, bring that to the former president's house. He then later clarified, though, that he wasn't actually encouraging people to go to the house, just trying to go to the former president's house and just trying to make the point that this was not loving by any means. And the president only put out a more stern rebuke of what was going on after hours of being coaxed by those around him who were able to convey to him in some regard that what was going on was very serious. But we've even seen in interviews in the aftermath recently with my colleagues Carol Lenig and Phil Rucker that the president has still sympathized with these people who committed violent crimes at our nation's capital.
So the hearing happened yesterday, and afterwards, Jacqueline, you reported that House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy said he didn't watch it, and there seemed to be a general lack of interest on the part of House Republicans. Why was that?
Yeah, I think it's for a number of reasons. One, I think that House Republicans realize that they're in a politically perilous situation right now. They don't necessarily want to have to defend the former president and the party's reaction as of late to the insurrection that happened on January 6th. They also don't want to be in the position of having to attack law enforcement. This is, after all, the party of quote unquote law enforcement. And I think it serves them better to feign ignorance and to try to tune it out than to have to react and potentially attack some of the testimony given by four police officers who risked their lives that day to save everyone in that building. You did have some Republicans like Rodney Davis and Kelly Armstrong, actually two of the Republicans who were initially handpicked by Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy to serve on the Select Committee, who said that they were able to actually catch snippets of the testimony and did worse among the only Republicans to publicly sympathize with those police officers, saying that they deserved the opportunity to tell their stories, that it was cathartic. But most of the response immediately pivoted back to calling the investigation a sham and trying to discredit Democrats and their investigative mission. You know, most of the reactions that we heard from House Republicans after the hearing broke up and members went to their votes was basically that the hearing accomplished nothing, even though they didn't watch it, and that key questions of security that are still lingering, like why there was a lapse, why police officers were so ill-prepared, why the federal government was so ill-prepared, that those have yet to be answered.
And that Republican indifference drew one of the most emotional moments of the hearing from one of the Capitol police officers who was injured, Michael Fanone.
The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful. My law enforcement career prepared me to cope with some of the aspects of this experience. Being an officer, you know your life is at risk whenever you walk out the door, even if you don't expect otherwise law-abiding citizens to take up arms against you. But nothing, truly nothing, has prepared me to address those elected members of our government who continue to deny the events of that day, and in doing so, betray their oath of office.
So, Jacqueline, having heard that testimony and others like it, from, in this case, Officer Fanone describing his injuries, including, in his case, a brain injury and being knocked unconscious for around 4 minutes, and of course, we know not everyone even got out alive. Doesn't that testimony by members of law enforcement put the law and order party on the spot in a way that downplaying it or Leader McCarthy saying he didn't even watch wouldn't go over well with their constituents?
Yeah, and I think that's something that Minority Leader McCarthy is really grappling with right now. There is perhaps the loudest constituency in his conference right now are the Marjorie Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz, and Paul Gosars of the world who are peddling disinformation and an alternative reality to what the events that actually happened on that day. That's why I think you've seen sort of attempts at counter-programming by McCarthy and leadership that preceded the hearing yesterday. But the loudest voices continue to propagate and downplay the severity of the events that happened on January 6th. I think that one of the things that GOP leadership didn't potentially anticipate from the decision to pull back the Republican members from participating in the Select Committee was that they were also going to be losing their megaphone and the opportunity to influence any messaging, to be there in the spotlight, to ask their questions, and to at least, you know, if they did have any interest in answering some key security questions, to display some of that interest in a hearing setting. But now they've sort of they're struggling from the sidelines to get through and are have left the messaging up to the police officers and Democrats and you know, it's not even fair for me to say that messaging the police officers who told their stories and their truth and want those who have downplayed the events of that day to recognize that. Republicans have said that they're going to conduct a parallel investigation into January 6th, but so far the details of that have been very vague. And Minority Leader McCarthy told us yesterday that he'd keep us updated, but that was still the plan.
So in our last 30 seconds, what comes next? Yesterday was only day one of this committee's work.
Yeah, what comes next is really a scramble. Democrats on the committee have said they're trying to get this done as quickly as possible. We're going to see subpoenas issued by the end of August or first week of September. Whether or not those who are subpoenaed will comply with those is a different story. It could really spark some extended litigation. There's also going to be more witnesses called. But right now, what Chairman Thompson has told us is he's going to give the staff the opportunity to catch up and get their bearings. And then while members are out on recess for a few weeks, which might potentially be cut short to come back here early, they're going to sort of collect all of the necessary pieces, identify those evidentiary gaps, and see what outstanding document requests are, still exist and who else needs to be talked to, from financiers, people who funded those who traveled to the Capitol that day, to the hundreds of indictments that have already been released by the Justice Department, to potentially subpoenaing people like former President Trump, members of Congress, really anyone involved with the events of the day. It is a broad scope. Lawmakers have made that much clear.
All right. We didn't get to the attending physician of the House of Representatives saying there should be mask wearing again in the House because of the Delta variant and other things that are going on. We'll get to that in a later segment. We thank Jacqueline Alemany, Washington Post correspondent, who also writes their daily newsletter called Power Up, and Devlin Barrett, Washington Post correspondent, focusing on national security and law enforcement, and author of the book October Surprise, How the FBI Tried to Save Itself and Crashed an Election. Thank you both so much.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Thanks.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.